This is Kate Moorhead Carroll in the podcast Find It. Today I have the extraordinary opportunity of talking with a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times journalist. Kevin Sack is the author of Mother Emmanuel, Two Centuries of Race, Resistance, and Forgiveness in One Charleston Church. Kevin has spent his life writing for the New York Times and traveling the world, but throughout his life there has been a theme of civil rights and the beauty that he finds in the movement in this country. Kevin, I've often moved by the working of God, and I really feel like God's brought you to us. We're feeling kind of lost right now, and we're grateful for you. So thank you for being here this morning.
Well, I can't thank you enough, Dean Kate, for the invitation, and thank you and to Catherine for organizing this. And it's great to see this wonderful crowd this early in the morning. I really appreciate everybody showing up for this. And it's after spending 10 years around the lowly Methodists, it's nice to be back in high church.
You know, so. We're grateful. Well, of course, our first question is, where were you born in Jacksonville?
So I grew up on the south side. My mom, Carol Sack, is here. My dad passed about a dozen years ago. He was an attorney in town. And we lived over in the Lakewood area, not too far from Oaklawn Cemetery. And I went to Hendricks Avenue Elementary.
Oh, great school.
Very good school. In fact, I've got a nephew there now.
Wonderful.
And it's kind of cool to see him following in the footsteps. And then went to Bowles and graduated from there.
Oh, great, yeah. Great. Well, we're so honored that you're from Jacksonville.
This town has always been home, obviously, and we're back all the time, and it's great to be back for this.
Mm. Well, you know, and you're a journalist, and before we even get into the book, I'm curious about journalism and communication is changing so much in this country, and what you've given us here is so grounded in fact, and it's so beautifully written. Tell us a little bit about how you understand the changes that are happening in communication in this country.
I mean, it's a totally different field than when I joined, and I have to say when aspiring journalists come to me looking for advice about how to get into the business these days, I kind of shrug because my experience is so irrelevant to theirs. They need such different skills than I had. I needed to know how to report and interview and write. You know, they need to know how to produce and podcast and do video, and it's just it's a multimedia field now, and obviously the most significant difference is just the way that the timelines have shrunk and deadlines have shrunk. That, you know, we now have almost no time to produce a story before it's got to go up, particularly in a breaking news situation. And we certainly saw a lot of that this week. A good example of it that comes from the book is I covered the famous speech eulogy by President Obama for the about 10 days after the shootings, and there was a press riser in the back of the arena where this was held, and my fingers were just flying as he was giving the eulogy. There was no White House transcript of the speech yet, but I knew that essentially the moment that he stop talking, I was going to have to file this story. So there's just not the time that there once was, often for reporting, for fact checking, for thinking, for context. It's just a speeded up business these days. I was very fortunate in the last stage of my career at the Times, the last 10 or 15 years of it. I did almost exclusively long-form investigative narrative work where we really did have the license to take time, and my stories often took, you know, 9 months or a year or even 2 years to produce, but that's very much the exception these days.
It's so interesting from a religious perspective how the darkness works through rushing, because then we only react. We don't have time to interpret or digest or really be wise.
And there's obviously no filter in the way that there used to be. You know, I think as maligned as the mainstream media is, one of the real services that it provides is as a curator. I mean, you know, these are people who are trained, editors who are trained to curate the news, to tell you what's important, to make sure that stories are complete. And now that, you know, anybody with a laptop or even a phone really has access to the media, to be the media, that's all changed. There are no checks and balances in the way there used to be.
Just this morning, I encountered a woman before the early service who was weeping, having read a bunch of horrible stuff and seen horrible things on the news. And we talked about, as a church, we might begin to try to instruct people about a media diet, because we do have to control what goes into us, just like we would with food. I read the New York Times every day. I try to read the Wall Street Journal. I like those printed papers. Of course, I read them on my phone. That's okay, right?
Absolutely.
But I myself know that imagery on television is not something that I receive as well. Mm-hmm. Tell us about how a person could craft their own media diet in this day and age. What would you recommend?
Well, the two papers you suggested, obviously, I do still think that you know, the big newspapers produce a high quality product. So the Washington Post, the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Associated Press, I think those are all still really reliable places to get the news. It's interesting, in the introduction they mentioned this project that I had worked on at the LA Times that won a Pulitzer. Well, my co-author of that project, who I was just on the phone with yesterday, Alan Miller, when he left daily journalism, he formed something called the News Literacy Project. And he was totally prescient. This was before the first Trump administration, before we started to be barraged with this concept of fake news. But he saw it coming, and he created this now nationwide program to start training teachers, really, and schools on how to get kids to understand how to consume media and what was real and what wasn't. And it's obviously a much more of a burden today than it was when we came up.
Repeat the name of that organization.
News Literacy Project.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, that's
great.
That
sounds awesome. Well, thank you. And thank you for the work that you're doing, really telling the truth and speaking in fact and history. So you've had the most marvelous career, and it's been, you've traveled the world, and you've gravitated towards civil rights. Tell us how you came to focus on that particular area of world history. I mean, it's why then? Why not, why that issue?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I grew up in a very segregated Jacksonville. I mean, I was born in 1959, so this is 5 years after Brown versus Board, but those of us who are from here know that the schools here didn't desegregate until the early 70s. I graduated from Bowles without ever going to school with a single black classmate. That changed in college, obviously, where I did develop friendships with black students. And more importantly, I was a history major at Duke and sort of focusing on recent American history. And I became just enamored, I think, with the romance of the civil rights movement. Here was a piece of democracy that had worked, you know? And when you look back on it today, it really is remarkable what an achievement it was. And at incredible cost, both in, you know, lives and time and anguish, but nonetheless, this was sort of democracy at its most fundamental, affecting change. And I think I was deeply taken by that. My first job after college was with the Atlanta Constitution, and so now I'm thrown into this world where the city is transitioning from white governance to black governance. Mm. And the new leaders of metropolitan Atlanta are the lions of the civil rights movement who have now come back to take power. So I'm spending my days hanging around with Maynard Jackson and Andy Young and John Lewis and Julian Bond.
Oh, awesome.
Joe Lowry, Hosea Williams. It was quite an education for a cub reporter. And that fascination just endured. Sort of any opportunity I got to find stories at the intersection of race and politics, or race and the environment, or race and faith, they really drew me in. And I spent a lot of my career on stories like that. The most notable example, which was another one that was mentioned before that was part of a Pulitzer-winning package, was The Times did this series in 2000 called How Races Lived in America. Two editors, one white, one black, got together and decided they wanted to assess where the country was on race at the turn of the millennium. Wow. But they didn't want to do it in traditional ways, by looking at statistical measures or looking at policy debates. Instead, they wanted to insert reporters, embed reporters, really, into actual interracial relationships in different settings around the country. So someone was in an army unit. Somebody was in a newsroom. Somebody was in a corporate boardroom. I chose to go to an integrated Pentecostal church in the Atlanta suburbs. And it was just the most fascinating experience, and obviously impeccable training for this book. I went into this place with an utterly preconceived notion that the integration of this congregation would be superficial, that they would be sitting next to each other in the pews on Sunday morning, and then they would go back to their segregated neighborhoods and their segregated schools and their segregated social lives. Couldn't have been more wrong. Really? They were all up in each other's lives, all week long. Birthday parties, housewarmings, rooming with each other on church retreats. But as I spent more time there, I found that despite the earnestness of the integration of the place, they couldn't suppress the role that race played, that it popped up everywhere, whether it was in the style of the music or who was leading the Bible study, down to the complexion of the infant that was used in the Christmas pageant to represent baby Jesus. And a very wise choir director made a solomonic decision to split the difference and found an interracial couple with a brand new baby. Through all of that, I spent a lot of time in and around black churches. And as a result of that, when this happened, this horrific event happened on June 17th, 2015, I think I was, I really felt the depth of the desecration that had happened there. For a white guy, I think I had, you know, a certain sense for the importance, the symbolic importance of a black church like Emmanuel, and what the attack on these people really meant, that it was not just a random attack on these individuals that happened to be in the fellowship hall that night. It was more a symbolic genocide, really, that was intended.
We would say that you had found your true calling from God, and God had been preparing you all that time, and God who's beyond time, to know that you would be able to do something like this. I want to touch upon a word you used right at the beginning when you said romance. When I think of the civil rights movement, I don't think of romance. Why romance? What is the reason for you choosing that word?
Because it was successful. Because you had people living out their commitment and their faith and doing it together, doing it communally.
So you see it as a story of love in the end, a story of love triumphing.
Absolutely. And, you know, romance may certainly be the wrong word to depict it, but I was smitten with the story.
Yeah, it's beautiful. No, I don't think you have an accidental word choice. You're pretty good with words, I'd say. So the shooting happens at Mother Emmanuel Church, and tell us about the discernment that led you to the writing of this book.
So we were home in Atlanta when this happened. I was watching CNN and reading the paper when the first reports came in real time. And, you know, the first report was simply that there had been a shooting at a church in downtown Charleston. And I heard that and I sort of thought, well, it's odd, but it could have been anything. Could have been a domestic dispute or a robbery or a feud between board members, you know, who knows. And then the next sentence out of the guy's mouth was, the address seems to correlate with Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church. And when I heard African Methodist Episcopal Church, my heart just sort of sunk. I guess maybe because I had spent so much time writing about race in the South, my every jaded instinct suggested that, to me, that this was going to wind up being the horrific hate crime that it was. And literally that night I started Googling the church. I'd never heard of the place, even though I'd spent considerable time in Charleston reporting and as a tourist. And up popped just the skeleton of the church's history, that it was the oldest AME church in the South, that it had been formed out of this almost subversive walkout from white Methodist churches by disaffected black congregants. The pastor who reformed the church during Reconstruction went on to become one of the 16 black Republicans elected to Congress during Reconstruction. Booker T. Washington had spoken there in 1909. W.B. Du Bois had spoken from the pulpit in 1921. Dr. King in 1962. His widow, Coretta Scott King, in 1969. I was just awestruck by everything that had happened before this night. And clearly that this night was going to be a landmark in the country's racial history. So I'm already starting to think, you know, I wonder if there's something bigger to say about this place and whether there might be a way to use this church, not just to tell the church's individual story, but to use it as a vehicle to tell a broader story of African-American life in Charleston. Charleston being, in my view, you know, maybe the most critical place to our understanding of America's racial narrative, because almost half of the enslaved Africans who disembarked in North America did so in Charleston. The Civil War began there. Then 2 days after the shootings, we'll all remember, there was a bond hearing, first court appearance for the shooter who had been arrested one day after the shootings while fleeing in North Carolina. They bring him back to Charleston. Family members are in the courtroom. None of them know that they're going to be given an opportunity to speak. But the judge calls upon them, asks them if anybody has anything they wish to say. And one after the next, five of them troop up to the microphone and offer some expression of forgiveness towards this, at that point and still to this point, remorseless white supremacist mass murder. So I think, like everybody, I assume, I was sort of simultaneously awestruck and befuddled by that and wanted to know more. Where did it come from? What did it actually mean? Was it the way that I think particularly white listeners perceived it? Is that what they intended? And decided that if there was a way to understand that, it was going to be through studying the history of the congregation and the history of the denomination. So there really were these sort of two parallel threads, one historical and one theological, that came together to drive the research.
You do. You start the book by talking about that moment, that forgiveness, and the church today, but then you go back to discuss the roots and the beginnings of the book. How did it strike you that going deep into one congregation in one place would be able to make such an impression about the civil rights movement as a whole?
Well, I thought that the real value, one of the real values that this story held, is that so much of our history, not just African American history, but any sort of history, is somewhat narrowly focused, right? It's a biography of an individual, or it's the story of a moment, a movement, an event, maybe a year or a decade. What I liked about this was that this church, because it was 200 years old, provided an opportunity to tell this longer story and to show that connectedness of events, to show how enslavement gave way to resistance to enslavement, which gave way to the Civil War, which led to Reconstruction, which led to Jim Crow, which led to the Civil Rights Movement, which led to the eventual political empowerment of blacks in this country. And where the narrative really started to click for me and sort of come together as a structure was when I realized that there were almost larger than life figures that coursed through each of these eras of the church's life that I could use to hang chapters on. I knew that, you know, I wasn't going to be able to get anyone to read a dry recitation of just sort of the church's day-to-day life through those years. But if I could make a compelling character out of Morris Brown, the founder of the congregation, or of Denmark Vesey, who plotted the slave insurrection, or of Richard Harvey Kane, the congressman that I mentioned, B.J. Glover, the civil rights leader, that would bring the story alive.
Yeah. It's amazing that Abraham Lincoln was invited to be there, right? And did not say yes, so he was assassinated? Or he's invited to be part of a parade?
At the close of the Civil War, there was a huge celebration at Fort Sumter, in which, yes, there were notables from all over the country, I think senators, Supreme Court justices, abolitionist leaders, who came back to Sumter to see the flag that had been lowered in disgrace raised once again, and the fort declared to be the property of the U.S. government once more. And I assume Lincoln was invited. I'm not positive of that, but he sent his executive secretary. Yeah. And it's a shame that he didn't go himself, because that night he was killed at Ford's Theater.
Wow. Yeah. Well, this is a story about what a church can be and what a difference it can make. And we're a church, too, that's very old. We were started in 1834, as it says over there. Tell us, based on all of this depth of wisdom and knowledge that you have, what are some lessons that you learned from this church that you could give to us? How can we make a difference in this crazy world? What would you advise that we do?
Not sure I'm really qualified to be giving you that kind of advice. What's been remarkable about the time that I spent there is just the sense of community of the place. I sense you've got that here as well, so I don't know that there's much that I can, you know, instruct you on in terms of that, but it's amazing how we were welcomed in. I mean, you know, I showed up there, Dean and I went to services there for the first time. I think it was the third Sunday after the shootings. They've been through this just unimaginable trauma, and imagine the logistical complexities. They've got 9 funerals, one of them in which the President of the United States and the Vice President and God knows how many senators are in town. The media horde, you know, just incomprehensible what they had to do. And nonetheless, the grace that they showed, there was a lot of division in the congregation about the form of grace that was expressed at the bond hearing, the forgiveness for this killer.
I imagine that upset some.
Those folks were not speaking for everybody.
Yeah.
But the grace that was shown towards us was universal. And that first Sunday, we were invited down to the fellowship hall, the very scene of the killings, which had, by this point, obviously been cleaned up and was back in use. They had a repast there after services, and we were welcomed down and introduced around. I met the oldest member of the congregation that day, who was, I think, 102 or 3. And that's continued all the way through, you know. I get asked on a regular basis, well, what did they think? How did they approach the fact that you were a white guy coming into this church at this point to write this book? And I have to say that, you know, there may have been plenty of talk behind my back. I can't know for sure, but we were never confronted to our faces. There was nothing but warmth. So I don't know. I guess, you know, find a way to respond with that kind of love and equanimity under the worst of circumstances.
Yeah, there's something powerful about a community that truly cares for one another and disagrees with one another and sticks it out together. We have so much Christianity now that's all over the screens, and that's all these big mega churches, but the parish, the community of believers that sit together in the pews and eat breakfast together, there still is value in that, isn't right. there?
Yeah, and I think you do feel that community there. Now, the place has really changed, obviously. You know, it can never regrettably go back to being the same place. And among the reasons for that is it's now, in addition to being a working church, it's a shrine.
Yeah.
Tour groups come through all week long. And on Sunday mornings, you know, they don't draw a big crowd to begin with, maybe 100 folks on an average Sunday. And I'd say a third of them usually are visitors, many of them white. And there's a varied reaction to that within the congregation. Some folks see this as the silver lining, right? Maybe this was what God had in mind, was to bring these people into the church, folks that would have had no exposure otherwise, and teach them what we're about. And there's also just an appreciation for their physical presence. I think there's an understanding that they are there with only the best intentions, that it's all good-hearted. And of course, they fill up the collection plate as well, which doesn't hurt. But there are others who feel like, you know, this is not our church anymore. And they walk in on Sunday morning and the family pew is filled with a bunch of tourists wearing t-shirts and shorts. You know, that doesn't always sit so well.
Right. Well, and their story is not over either. We don't know. Based on your book, more is to come, most likely, for that place and for those people. But it is a story of gentle resurrection into something that I don't think it's yet fully become, would you say? It's not yet finished.
No, I think it will be, you know, a very long recovery. And I know for me, and obviously I didn't know any of the victims personally, I feel like I've come to know them through their stories. But even for me, unlike everyone else in the church who knew all of the victims generally, I mean, they all knew everybody because it was a small enough place. When I'm there on Sundays, it's hard to escape the feeling that the dead are always with us there. I can, you know, look across the aisle and see Blondell Gadsden, and you know, I can't help but think, oh, well, her sister died in the attack. I wonder how she's doing today. Or I would lean back over the pew to gossip with Willie Glee, who was the church historian, and then remember, well, he's only here because he got hungry that night and went out to Ruby Tuesday to get a bite to eat instead of staying for Bible study. So it's... Yeah, it's hard to not be thinking about what happened one floor below your feet. Mm.
And that is the battle that we have these days, is there's so much darkness that we witness all over the news and media. And choosing the light and choosing to hope and have and believe in God's grace is really a battle. But the very fact that they are existing and moving forward, and that you gave them this great gift of knowing them so deeply gives me hope for their future.
Well, and I think they, I don't know if they receive it as a gift, but I think they certainly, I think we had common cause, and that certainly helped my ability to research the book. I think they did not want this congregation to be forever known only for what happened that night. Mm-hmm. And that was my goal too. I didn't think it should be either. And I thought that all of us should understand why it mattered that it happened where it did. That this was not a randomly selected church. You know, it's still a bit of a question how much the killer actually knew about the place, but he knew enough to know that again, he was not just walking into any other church.
And circling back to the question we addressed at the very beginning, this killer, like so many of them, was all over the internet and influenced by things that were at base false and hate-based. What can we continue to do to try to cultivate more of a healthy environment in which our young people can be fed information that's truthful?
Yeah, I don't know how we do it in this sort of unregulated, internet environment. And I, fear obviously we're going to see the same sort of influence on the Charlie Kirk incident. But what happened with this kid? He was 21 years old. He was a high school dropout. He had high innate intelligence. IQ tests showed him to be quite intelligent, and his taste ran towards opera and NPR. He was well read, but he after dropping out of high school, basically locked himself up in his room with little more than his computer. And yes, he went down this internet rabbit hole that he never managed to escape. This supposedly started right after the Trayvon Martin incident. And he gets online and he Googles black on white crime. And up pops a variety, I think, of white supremacist websites with bad information. And, it was that information that he referred to as he was shooting in the fellowship hall. He talked about you're raping our women every day and taking over the world. His trial was deeply unsatisfying in trying to figure out what drove him and how, he had devolved in this way, because some of you may remember, if you followed it, he sidelined his own defense lawyers for the second half of the trial. First half of the trial was guilt or innocence, which was a slam dunk. He had confessed. There was video. There was no question. The second part was death penalty or life in prison, and his court-appointed attorneys, who are quite skilled and quite experienced, were desperate, obviously, to figure out any way to convince just the one juror they needed that he merited, being spared from the death penalty. And the obvious way to do that is to mount a psychiatric defense.
Sure.
He was intent that they would not do that. He was determined to make it clear to everybody that he was a zealot, not a lunatic. And that he was in no way crazy. He had meant to do this, and he had achieved his purpose. So he literally petitioned the judge to allow himself to represent himself during the penalty phase of the trial. And he did. And he got up and he presented a sort of rambling 5-minute opening argument and a 5-minute closing argument, presented no evidence, no witnesses, and that was it. Now, there had been competency hearings before the trial to determine whether or not he could do this. They were closed to the press and the public, but the documentation was unsealed after the fact, after the verdict. And so I and other journalists were able to study it. And what came through that, there were all sorts of psychological analyses by both defense and prosecution experts. And they concluded that, yes, he was somewhere on the autism scale. He had some other relatively minor psychological diagnoses, mainly social anxiety and things like that. And the autism in no way explained or excused what he did, right? There are plenty of people with an autism diagnosis, probably plenty of white supremacists with an autism diagnosis who do not then take the additional step of staking out a church half a dozen times, buying a weapon, and walking into Bible study and opening fire. But one thing that did make sense to me from those studies is that one of the psychologists said that once he seized on white supremacy once he decided that in some way this ordered his disordered world. He focused on it with an autistic fixation. Mm-hmm. And I thought that made a certain amount of sense in explaining why he had not been able to climb back out.
Wow. So again, to the extent that we can keep ourselves loving ourselves, keep track of our own youth, try to keep them digesting something that's good for them,
yeah.
We just have to work in our sphere and move out as much as we can.
I think so. And obviously most of it starts in the family. Yeah. People ask me about his family. He came from a divided family. His parents had split up. They actually had split before he was born, and he was conceived during a relatively brief reunion, and then they split up again. I think there was a lot of instability. He mostly lived with his mother, who sort of bounced around from place to place, and I think did not, you know, wasn't monitoring him in the way that she could have. But I don't think that white supremacy or racism was sort of the, wasn't a significant factor in these households. I think it existed in the way that it does in a lot of run-of-the-mill white Southern families. I'm sure there was, you know, a slur from time to time, but you don't get the impression that this was, you know, a family of Klansmen.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the end, we see these beautiful people who died, and as followers of Jesus, we believe that they're fine. It's the rest of us left behind that have a lot of work to do. But you have done an amazing thing, and I hope you understand that. This is a work of art. I hope you all will read it. I've read it cover to cover. And this is a gift, and I hope it helps us to move more deeply into understanding race relations, but also to remember that real truth and the understanding of complexity take time, don't they? We shouldn't rush so much in trying to understand things.
Yeah. Well, 10 years in this case.
10 years.
Yes, it did take time. Yeah. And I think it took a lot of time because I followed my own curiosity. You know, so much of this story I didn't know. Not just the particular history of the church, obviously, but I didn't know what Methodism really was when I started, and didn't know who the Wesleys were and how they had founded the denomination, and certainly didn't understand the impact that their visits to Savannah and Charleston had on their eventual decision to make this an abolitionist faith. Didn't understand anything about how African Methodism had been born, or really what it was, either theologically or historically. So it was really, you know, a wonderful, stimulating, you know, experience all the way through. It was just I learned so much.
And we're grateful for you. Let's tell him thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Kevin Sack will be here to sign books and to answer any of your questions. We're so grateful that you were here today. Thank you so much
Thank
for coming.
Thank you. Thanks again for having me.
Thank you for joining me in this amazing conversation with Kevin Sack. I pray that the Lord will bless you and keep you.